6. We're sticking with politics now, and I suppose one of the most febrile periods of politics in Ireland in 1982. We're going to take you all the way back to that because a new book is out, just released, The Murder and the Taoiseach, Death, Politics and Gooboo, revisiting the notorious Malcolm MacArthur case. The writer is, of course, Harry McGee of Irish Times, the Irish Times political correspondent. He's with me on the line. Harry, good morning to you. Can you hear me?
Hi, Jerry. How are you?
Yes, great, apologies. Technical problems there. But listen, you were talking about the glorious weather we're having today, and we are having glorious weather. And that day when Bridie Garrigan sadly lost her life in 1982.
Yeah, brutally attacked with a lump hammer as she was sunbathing in the Phoenix Park by somebody, nobody knew who it was, a mystery man who arrived, attacked her, and then just made his escape. And then 2 days later, a young farmer down in County Offaly, in Edenderry, just at the start of the Bog of Allen, Jerry, his name was Donald Dunn. He was selling a shotgun. He was a member of a clay pigeon shooting club there. He used to hunt with dogs as well. Selling his gun, this man arrived to look at his gun. They went out to the shooting range to have a look at it. Donald Dunn demonstrated the gun, and a second later, he handed the gun to the guy, and the guy just shot him dead at point-blank range. So two brutal murders happening within a period of days. Both the guards quickly realised that both had been perpetrated by the same mystery man who was completely outside the radar. Wasn't a usual suspect or a criminal. They just couldn't figure out who it was. And that spawned huge fear. I mean, Ireland was such a quiet place back then. Of course, the troubles were on in the north, but murders were very infrequent in the south. Even in the capital, Dublin, the drugs issue hadn't really started at that stage. It was just beginning, really. And the whole notion of kind of drug gangs and kind of criminal gangs was very new in Dublin at the time. So these two murders really captivated people for the whole of the summer, and created huge fear amongst the community. And the Gardaí launched what was until then the biggest manhunt in Irish police history, involving at some stage 60 or 70 detectives as they scoured the north and south of Dublin, Edenderry, County Offaly, looking for clues for this killer. And of course, like everything else in life, Jerry, there was very strong Kerry connections at the beginning and at the end of it. At the beginning, the murder hunt was led by John Courtney, detective inspector, controversial figure from Annisgall, County Kerry, and a superb criminal detective, one of the great murder squad detectives in Irish police history, Tony Hickey, from just outside Killarney, who was a detective sergeant and was one of the lead investigators on that particular crime.
Amazing. One of the fascinating things about the book is what you found out and what you write in terms of Malcolm MacArthur himself and his personality. He was a strange fish, a kind of fantasist, really, but someone who had started off very wealthy, dwindled away his inheritance, and that set him on this bizarre path down the road of two murders.
That's it, yeah. He came from a very well-to-do family in County Meath. They were kind of castle Catholics, aristocratic Catholics. His mother's family also came from a very rich landowning family from County Westmeath, so they had a lot of money when he was growing up. He had a governess. He was bound for a private school over in England, but then there was a change in the family fortunes and they began to lose money. He ended up going to a local Christian Brothers school in Trim in County Meath, but he was always a slightly quiet, studious boy. His parents' marriage was falling apart as well. His parents were very distant, so he grew up being a little bit of an oddball, really. A person who didn't speak very much, but looked very exotic. He started wearing dicky bows and silk cravats and kind of set himself up as this bohemian. So there was a change in his fortune in the mid-20s when his father passed away, because he inherited the house, which he sold, and he got the equivalent of about €1 million or more, and that allowed him to set himself up as a kind of a man about town. So he never worked. He went, hung around kind of fashionable bars and went to cafes and stuff, and led the life of a kind of a man of leisure. And it was only when the money began to run out in the early 1980s that he began to devise this extraordinary plan to recover his fortunes. He read about the IRA committing armed burglaries in post offices and banks, and he said, "I'll have a bit of that." So he tried to set himself up as an armed robber, but he had no life skills. He didn't know what to do. He had no criminal contacts. He had no criminal connections. So he went about it in the most cack-handed way, but unfortunately it was also a brutal way.
Yeah. So he was trying to get a gun and a car to get the gun, and both those things led to the two murders.
Yeah, sure. He went to the Phoenix Park to get a car. He saw the Bridie Garden was sunbathing. He tried to get the car off her. And he could have just taken the car because he pointed what looked like a gun at her. But then for some reason he told her to get into the car, which there was no need. He could have just driven off with the car. He would never have been caught. And she panicked, obviously, when she was put into the car because she thought something else was going to happen. And something else did happen. He himself exploded and attacked her with a hammer and bled her to death. It was just awful. And the same with Donald Dunn. He went down to get a gun, really. But when the man showed him the gun, he decided that he'd get rid of the man as well. And the poor farmer was shot there. And then, after showing a gun to this man to demonstrate, it was awful. Like, brutal, callous, remote. He had no inkling or no feeling for any of the people that he encountered along the way. I think his attitude was that anybody who gets in my way while I'm doing this escapade, I'm going to kill. So it was well outside the realm of anything that we could even begin to imagine as normal human behaviour.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is a reminder for a lot of people, but also there's a huge amount of new information you uncovered through the podcast and interviews with people and hearing the stories of those, like I was thinking of Paddy Byrne, the man who almost stopped it in its tracks when he first came upon him in the Phoenix Park and wrestled with MacArthur and almost got the better of him.
He did. He was a farmer. He was a farmer originally, but he was a gardener then who worked in the American Ambassador's residence in the middle of Phoenix Park. And he was just finishing his day's work. He lived inside in a cottage. And he was walking back towards his cottage when he saw MacArthur loping around, hiding, scurrying around in the trees. And he thought that he looked very strange. And so he had a look at him. He saw him approaching the nurse. He saw them having a conversation and then getting into the car. And then he could see that there was something happening inside the car that didn't look right. So he went over to investigate. He saw that the nurse had been very badly injured and he tried to wrestle with MacArthur. MacArthur pointed a gun at him and told him to back away or he'd blow his effing head off. But Paddy Byrne was very brave. He grabbed the gun, but his hands were very stippy and he wasn't able to grasp it. He fell on the ground and your man just jumped into the car and drove off. And Paddy Byrne almost caught him and would have prevented the other robbery. But unfortunately, he eluded him. So I had a chat with Paddy, who's now in his mid-80s. And living in Cabra for the podcast. So he was great to get because he had great, vivid recollections of that very scary, unreal moment in time, Jerry.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely astonishing. I suppose nobody who was involved, and even from interviews of people who saw him in the pub when he was going to shave, trying to change his identity because he was effectively on the run from that point, everyone remembers the strange figure. And he was a really strange figure. His garb, his clothes, the fisherman's jumper. He was just so bizarre in how he went about his business. It just was so strange for everyone. Everyone kind of remembers that time when they came across him.
Yeah, I use a line from a novel by K.C. Chesterton, the man who was Thursday, and basically, you know, if you want nobody to find you, don't look like you're in hiding. And what he tried to do is he said he was going to kind of disguise himself and make himself look different, but his garb was so ridiculous that people noticed him everywhere he went. He had his stalkers. It was a heat wave. The temperatures were 25 degrees. And he was going around wearing big, heavy jumpers, one of those tweed fishermen's hats with a feather sticking out of it. He had glasses that he didn't need that had very thick lenses. So he was like Mr. Magoo going around wearing it. And this big, very obvious blue hold all bag. So everywhere he went, people saw him and said, that man looks very odd. So he was noticed everywhere he went. And then he managed to escape up to a pub after attacking Bridie Gargan up near Ballymun. And he went into the toilet and he shaved off the beard that he'd grown just using disposable razor blades with no cream. Sure, he hacked half the face off himself and the customers in the pub saw that. But the big difficulty was that very few people knew who Malcolm MacArthur was in Ireland. So the guards, he remained a mystery man for the guards until he started making mistakes later on that summer and kind of revealed his hand. And let the guards kind of know who he might be and what his identity was and allowed them to kind of focus in on him and zero in on him.
Yeah, yeah. And look, then it comes to the political side of things and Charles J. Haughey and Gubu, and how MacArthur ended up in the house of Patrick Connolly. Friends, of course, through his wife with Patrick Connolly.
Yeah, that's Patrick Connolly had met Brenda Little, Malcolm MacArthur's wife, in the early 70s. They just met by chance in Dublin. He was a well-to-do barrister. She was a young woman who was selling raffle tickets on the streets for a place up in North Dublin, home for children with intellectual disabilities. And Patrick Connolly, that was his hometown. So they had a chance conversation in the street, and then they became very good friends. They both liked opera, and they both liked film. So they used to go together and socialise together. And then she met Malcolm MacArthur and became his wife. They had a child together, but she continued her friendship with Patrick Connolly. Meantime, Patrick Connolly was a very good friend of Charlie Haughey. He represented Charlie Haughey during the arms trial in 1970, and they remained firm friends throughout the 70s. So when Charlie Haughey became Taoiseach in 1982, in February 1982, he rang Connolly and asked him to become his attorney general. So that's how the connection was made. Charlie Haughey, of course, didn't know Malcolm MacArthur, but Patrick Connolly was a kind of the person in the middle between those two parallel worlds. And then they collided, Gerry, in August when the guards centred in on Malcolm MacArthur. He carried out a botched armed robbery on a very rich American diplomat in Killiney. The American diplomat was a smart fella. He realised that this guy might end up shooting him with the shotgun he had. So he chose his moment and he fled out of his own house. MacArthur didn't catch him. The man was able to give a very good description of the assailant. He couldn't remember him, and the assailant told him that he'd been at a party in his house 7 or 8 years ago. But he was able to put guards in contact with a woman who might identify him, and she identified him immediately as Malcolm MacArthur. Separately, MacArthur had rang the Dalkey guard station that morning to pretend that what had happened was just a practical joke went wrong. But the sergeant asked him straight out, well, what's your name? And he blurted out Malcolm MacArthur. So they had a name, and they started trying to find out about this Malcolm MacArthur guy. And then they realised that he was a friend of Patrick Connolly's, and that he used to live in an apartment owned by Patrick Connolly, and that he might even be staying with Patrick Connolly in his apartment at Pile of View. And there he was. The guards ventured in, they moved in, they arrested him there, and it created a scandal of stupendous proportions. There was no social media back then, Gerry. But
it would have been all over Twitter, that's for sure, Harry.
The reaction would have gone out to space. It was just incredible.
Finally, Harry,
sensation even then.
Can you tell me briefly, this all played out as well to an extent in Ishfiqalan, Charlie Haughey's island off the coast of Kerry. There was a remarkable phone call from Paddy Connolly. It had to be routed through the village of Ballyferrater, the exchange. The line was crackly, but somehow at the end of it, Charlie Haughey gave the go-ahead for Paddy Connolly to head off on holidays in America in the middle of all this controversy.
He did. Paddy Connolly had to phone Charlie Haughey, and it was a bad line, but I think there might have been drink trade taken on one side that day, because it was the first day that Charlie Haughey was down on Inishvikalan. And I think the information that was conveyed from the other side by Patrick Connolly might not have told everything. I think he might have told what he needed to say without telling everything, because he really wanted to go on his holidays the next day, of course, which was a mistake in retrospect. So Charlie Haughey apparently said at the end of it, bon voyage. And it was only later the next day when Bertie Ahern and his own staff managed to contact him in the afternoon that he realised the gravity of the situation and realised he'd have to get Paddy Connolly back immediately. And as needless to say, the conspiracy theories were just endless at the time, you know, and most of them had, and all of them practically had no foundation in reality, but people chose to believe them, and everything that happened just added fuel to the fire. I was saying earlier on the week, Jerry, that it was almost like a Harlan Coben Netflix series, except all the unreal twists that happened were actually real, you know. It was just incredible. I mean, the story, it's still, even after 40 years, it's just an amazing, the story itself is just an amazing story. I don't think that there's ever been anything like it before or since in Irish political life.
Yeah, well, listen, it inspired the phrase Gubu. Harry, listen, we'll leave it there. Congratulations on the book and good success with it, and thanks for talking to us in the programme this morning.
A pleasure, Gerry. Thank you very much indeed.